Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. The number of anti-trans bills is rising nationwide in Republican-controlled states and legislatures. Some deal with the topic in general, but many focus in on children who are questioning their gender or who have already made that decision and are seeking gender-affirming care. These bills severely restrict that care, forbidding it under a certain age with severe penalties for those who attempt it. This has become the new focus of America's culture wars, and caught in the bullseye of this rancorous, scary, often ugly debate are children. And that's something that should concern all responsible adults, no matter how they feel about this issue. Some of these restrictions are particularly draconian. In Texas, Governor Greg Abbott issued a directive requiring child welfare agents to investigate gender-affirming medical procedures as child abuse, which could strip trans children from their families. In Virginia, Governor Glenn Youngkin unveiled new guidelines making it more difficult for trans youth to change their names or pronouns at schools. And that just scratches the surface. Imagine the impact this is having on young people already having to deal with something most of us take for granted, our gender identity. To help us better understand that impact, we invited some folks to enlighten us. Sarah McHale is Executive Director of Time Out Youth, a longtime Charlotte organization working with and for LGBTQ young people. Welcome back to the program, Sarah. Good to see you. You're welcome. Rodrigo Hang-Leitonen is Executive Director of the National Center of Transgender Equality. Thank you for joining us. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Hannah Schoenbaum is North Carolina State House reporter at the Associated Press. Hannah, thank you for being here too.
Thanks for having me.
Sarah, let me start with you. LGBTQ plus people and issues have gained, it seems, a lot of acceptance nationally around the country. Do you believe that is still the case, given what's going on in these Republican-controlled states, making these efforts by people on the right to limit gender-affirming care not representative of the country, or was this impression of acceptance a mirage?
Well, I think it's a both and. I think that there has been an increase in visibility, but what we know is that visibility does not equal justice. So we've seen trans people winning Grammys and on television, and you see queer representation in the media, which is so meaningful for everyone, particularly young people. But what we also know as an LGBTQ movement is when we make progress, it's when the other side tries to pull us back. So I believe that's what we're seeing. That progress is happening. Our young people are by and large queer. That's what the numbers are telling us, that youth are coming out younger, they're feeling safer to be themselves. And so I think that this backlash of essentially trying to criminalize existence, particularly for trans people, is a direct result of some of the progress that has been made.
And because of that progress, it seems, and you just mentioned it, a lot of young people are coming out at a younger age, mm-hmm. and also are more willing to step forward and say, I'm not really the gender you think I am. Mm-hmm. And that perhaps is exacerbating the speed and the intensity of the backlash, correct?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that isn't new. Trans people have existed since the beginning of time. Young people coming out is a thing that we see as positive, so that people don't have to wait their whole lives or never come out and feel safe. And so that's why we're so fiercely protective of that ability to exercise the right to be themselves, to be in supportive families, schools, doctor's offices. But I do think that that is a direct fear of the right to come and say, like, no, we can't let this happen, because of ignorance, honestly.
Some of the attacks, Rodrigo, that are being levied against trans people or people who would like to have gender-affirming care sound very much like what was said about LGBTQ people, lesbians and gays, in the early days. Why are trans people now the ones in the crosshairs?
Well, like Sarah was saying before, and I agree, progress comes with backlash. So what we're experiencing right now with what feels like this dramatic escalation in attacks on transgender people, both in legislatures, like you're saying, but also even physical attacks like hate crimes, we're seeing these attacks grow because actually we made so much progress. And now there's folks that, you know, have negative reactions to that. But you're absolutely right that what we're seeing now that specifically targeting transgender kids really sounds very familiar for earlier waves against LGBT people. So for example, we're hearing a lot of misinformation about what it means to be trans. That sounds a lot like the misinformation of what it's like to be gay or be in a same-sex relationship that we heard back in the 70s and 80s when stigma against that was much higher. So this is really the same playbook. Anti-LGBT ideologues and some politicians trying to score political points are using the same playbook that they used against marriage equality when they were trying to pass transgender bathroom bans in earlier years, especially in North Carolina. All of these are sort of the same repetition of the same patterns. And I think the reason they keep trying this is because the truth is not on their side. You know, the truth is that being LGBT is just the fact of life for a lot of people. You cannot change the fact that someone is transgender, just like you cannot change the fact that someone is gay. And so the truth is on our side, that this is just part of authentic life. But there are always going to be, unfortunately, some people who react negatively to that. And they don't really have much else they can go after us on that is honest. So they have to use misinformation.
But Hannah, as we've noticed of late, truth doesn't seem to matter to a lot of people on a lot of different topics. Moves to tighten restrictions for gender-affirming care, for instance, which can be life-saving in some instances, are happening in areas of the country in which Republicans are in control. And they're making a lot of decisions in those areas that seem to go against the grain of popular opinion. Is this a winning issue for Republicans here or around the country? Hannah.
Well, I think that is generally the hope for Republicans who are pushing a lot of these issues. I think we will have the true test of that come election season. But as you mentioned, we're seeing a lot of these same, sometimes identical bills pushed in state houses across the country, including in North Carolina, a lot of draft bills relating to LGBTQ youth, particularly trans youth, that are coming down the funnel from these same few groups that are, you know, national organizations that are pretty much blatantly anti-trans groups that are mentioning that trans youth in their perspective are a threat to communities and children, which, you know, activists largely say that is not true. These are just children who are trying to live their lives and live their truths authentically. But the perspective from right-wing activists and from some of these people who have been pushing the draft bills is that, you know, they're trying to rally community members who maybe have never met a trans person and, you know, by and large are afraid of what they don't know. And therefore that is causing some of this, you know, public outcry against trans people in every facet of life because, you know, they're scared of the impact this could have on their communities or their children. And I've seen a lot of trans people come to the legislature and share their own stories and say, if you just got to know me, you would probably oppose everything that's been said by the lawmakers in the room.
However, they may be getting some aid and comfort from public opinion polls, although the PBS NewsHour reports that a majority of Americans oppose restrictions against LGBT people, LGBTQ plus people, which includes trans. They also report that that new laws, support for these new laws is growing as millennials become more conservative. And maybe removing whatever societal stigma as we're moving toward this more open society. But at the same time, Republicans are making these moves. It's removing the societal stigma of being opposed to these advances. Hannah, is that the feeling among lawmakers in the legislature here, do you think?
I would say so. I've seen a lot of people who have testified, who are parents, who are generally, like I said before, afraid of what they don't know. These are people that come and say, I am pro-gay, I have gay relatives, but what I'm afraid of is my children either coming home and saying, you know, I don't identify as a girl or a boy, or I identify as non-binary. These are fairly new concepts in the minds of, you know, cisgender parents who don't have the experience of meeting trans people or interacting with trans people in their lives. And therefore, that's part of the reason I think that we're seeing a lot of people who are willing to jump on the bandwagon and support these bills. It's largely based on fear tactics. And that's why I think that young people are such an important wedge issue right now. It's, you know, when you can say this is for protecting children, who doesn't want to protect children? But the way that people are going about, you know, pushing that angle on either side of the issue around children, it's, you know, it's scaring LGBTQ youth because, you know, they're afraid that they're not going to be able to exist in their everyday lives in the classroom or in the doctor's office and things like that. And they're saying, you know, I'm not a threat to other kids, of course. But then you have, you know, parents and some cisgender youth on the other side of things who largely don't know what it's like to interact with these kids who are just trying to live their lives.
Rodrigo, I know you wanted to jump in here.
Yeah, I think what the polls show is really that the American public is still becoming familiar with what it means to be transgender in the first place. You know, there are polls that show that Americans are pretty conflicted about some of these very public controversies regarding transgender youth, especially the healthcare bans. But what they also show at the same time is that more and more Americans are saying that they know somebody who's trans, and that they support someone being transgender, that they don't think that there's anything wrong with that. And that might seem, those two poll results that we see over and over again these days might sound contradictory, but I take what might be a weird amount of hope out of that, because, you know, if you asked these same questions 20 years ago, you would have had only a tiny fraction of Americans saying that they know someone who's trans, and a tiny fraction saying that they think it's okay to be transgender. So what I mean is 20 years ago, the very idea of just being transgender in and of itself was pretty much ignored, demonized, or a punchline on late night TV. So now, fast forward to 2023, you have a lot more support for just being transgender in general, and a lot more support for the idea that there's nothing wrong with being transgender in and of itself. And that is a lot of progress. Now we're at a stage where a lot of Americans are just finding out for the very first time about what might feel like really complicated issues like healthcare, for transition-related healthcare. And I think it's perfectly natural for people to not understand things at first. We're all human. You know, all of us get overwhelmed by topics when we're learning about them for the first time. I'm really confident that with time, we're going to see that as more and more Americans do get to know their transgender neighbors and really understand that a lot of what they've been told about transition-related healthcare is a lie. A lot of what they've been told about transition-related healthcare is actually untrue, and that transition-related healthcare, including for kids, has long been studied. There are rigorous guidelines developed by the American Medical Association, American Psychological Association. As more and more people get to know that, they'll understand what this is really about.
And we will talk more about that throughout this hour. That's Rodrigo Hang-Layton, Executive Director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. We're coming right back. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, using Mazda's customer-centric approach to cars to create a car buying and servicing experience where the customer is the center of their business. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the trials and tribulations of facing trans people as moves are being made in states around the country to limit gender-affirming care and other aspects of that life. We're talking about it with Sarah McHale, Executive Director of Time Out Youth here in Charlotte. Rodrigo Heng-Leitinen is Executive Director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. And Hannah Schoenbaum reports on the State House for the Associated Press. Rodrigo, you have a particularly unique understanding of what we're talking about this morning, of what young transgender and gender-questioning people face, because this is a personal, this has been a personal journey for you in your life, and I'm sure it wasn't easy, and you've talked about some of the things that were difficult, particularly difficult 20 years ago, more so even than today, and it's difficult today. You not only have experience in this, but you had a unique and fortunate situation with your parents, one of whom was a Republican member of the House of Representatives. Talk about that.
Well, I'm a transgender man, so that means I was raised as a girl, but, you know, not exactly how things turned out. I transitioned and live as the man I know myself to be now. And yeah, my family is very Republican, and certainly there's a lot of stereotypes that Republicans would not support transgender people. But I'm very, very fortunate that my parents at least reacted by saying, hey, we don't understand this, but we love you and you're still our kid. And that is not to be taken for granted. My mother was a member of Congress at the time. And so we really reckoned with, not only for myself wondering, am I gonna lose my family by coming out as transgender, but also, am I gonna kill my mom's career? Is my mom gonna lose re-election? Because she's a Republican representing a Republican district. And now this scandal is going to come out that she has a transgender kid. And I was an adult already at the time, but still, you know, the elections can be brutal. So I'm very, very lucky that my parents still stood by me, both in our family and publicly. But I really wish that everybody had that experience. I wish that that wasn't rare. I wish that there was nothing special about that. No one should have to worry about losing their family or losing the people they love just because they're coming out. So that's why I do this work every day, to try to make my experience of acceptance be a normal one, so that no one has to worry about this anymore.
Was there political backlash for your mother?
Well, you know, she really went on the airwaves and really confronted this head on at the time, and was able to weather the storm. You know, there were journalists who unfortunately tried to make this a joke, or make her child being transgender into a political punching bag. But she really went on TV and said, this is my child. I am a mother and I'm here to protect my child. And I think that's really relatable, whether you're Republican, Democrat, independent. Most parents want what's best for their kids, and they want their kid to be safe. So I think when she was able to say that directly to the voters, say, you know, regardless of partisanship or politics, I'm a mom trying to protect my kid, I think people really heard that. I'm grateful for that.
Sarah.
Yeah, first of all, thank you so much, Rodrigo, for sharing your personal story with us. I think it is really meaningful and does some of that dispelling of the myths around what it means to be transgender. But I'll say, what we know is that 60% of young people grow up in non-affirming homes. So when we're fighting in this work, it is for those young people, right? Like, I worry about all trans young people in the political climate we're in right now, but a little bit less about the ones whose parents would move them out of this state, which, make no mistake, supportive families will leave North Carolina if these bills pass. I've talked to parents that don't want their children to grow up in a place where they can't get the healthcare that will save their lives. I talk to young people daily that say, hormones are the reason that I'm here, or getting puberty blockers are the reason that I'm still alive. The rates of suicide risk are so high. So I've been a social worker for nearly 20 years, and I believe that parents love their children. I do not believe that a parent who rejects their child is it because they don't love them. It is that fear. It is that rejection as protection is a thing that people say, particularly in faith communities, a lot. But we know the research tells us that that does not protect them, especially now when they're living in a world that is telling them that they're not okay, and in their homes. So that's the work that we're doing at Time Out Youth every day, is having young people come in and say that this is a place where I can be myself.
Yeah, the folks working against this because they're trying to protect the health of children are allegedly, I'm not a doctor, but it seems to me to be intuitive that you are damaging the health of children if you create an environment that is full of fear and repercussions for them being who they are. And you were on this program, Sarah, a year ago, and I'm just curious if the atmosphere has worsened in that time in terms of rising amounts of fear, in terms of the number of threats or hate crimes threatened or perpetrated against young gay people, young trans people that come to you at Time Out Youth?
Yeah, so I'll first say that I think a lot of that right-wing backlash, which I'm sure Hannah hears more than I do being there on the floor, but I've been to Raleigh to listen, to testify, I've taken young people, and they're speaking truth. So I think the hard part around polls that talk about what it means, what the community feels, the public feels about trans people are not even rooted in what we know and understand to be true about trans people, right? Every medical association has said that gender affirming care is life-saving. And so when a politician without that background speaks out and says that it's harmful, that's based in fear, not in fact.
When politicians in our states here, Hannah, are making these comments, I know they come from various different points of view. It comes from a religious point of view. It comes from a conservative versus liberal point of view. It comes from a worldview that's informed by your life and where you live and whom you live with. When they make these statements, are they operating because they truly believe them, or are they saying these things because it plays into the political ideology that will get them elected?
I can't speak to the personal opinions of any lawmaker. I know that there are a lot of lobbyists on the floor of the legislature, and they tend to talk about all sides of issues. But what I will say is that just in sitting in committee rooms this year, there has been little time for public comment on a lot of these issues. There could be a crowd of 30 something LGBTQ people and their families sitting in the back of the room, and a whole another line of maybe 50 of them out the door who didn't even get a seat in the committee room. And there will either be no time remaining for public comment after the lawmakers had their debate, or maybe one or two advocates or people sitting in the room will have a chance to speak. And so in just speaking with trans people and advocates outside of the committee room, or people who didn't have a chance to speak after committee, they had to sit there and listen to lawmakers pass a bill through committee that affects their livelihood without even having the chance to come up and speak on it. And people are really hurt by that. You know, I've heard a lot of Democrats in particular speak out against the Republican legislative leaders this year, saying, you know, at least let the democratic process work the way that it should. If you're going to make decisions that affect people's livelihood, let them speak. You know, please take their input into account, because, you know, if you aren't, you're not going to hear from the people who actually have personal experience on this matter or who are personally affected by it. There are trans youth who are, you know, coming out of school one day and maybe coming from, I've heard people come from as far away as Charlotte to the legislature who, you know, just were one of the first people in committee and were told, sorry, we don't have time for your testimony. And these are people who are dramatically affected by the issues that lawmakers are passing without input.
Sarah.
Yeah, just to echo that, we have gone, both myself and a few young people have gone from Charlotte to 8:30 a.m. committees and not been able to speak, or sometimes feels just as bad when our young people speak and there's a really big lack of interest. We're going to vote the way we're going to vote no matter who has come here, except for a few passionate people on both sides. It has felt really disheartening, and young people are just amazing. I'm here to talk. I'm here to tell my story. If they're not able to share on the committee floor, Equality NC, our LGBT advocacy arm in North Carolina, has been filming and putting their stories out so that they're being told. And it's it's incredibly disheartening to see some of these decisions that are being made about, to Hannah's point, people's lives, particularly young people, trying to ban young people from playing sports, particularly trans girls. It was stated by a Democrat that there was on record 3 transgender girls in North Carolina that wanted to play on girls' teams. And they said, are we really here because we want to block 3 girls from playing sports? Middle school and high school, not elite athletes, people wanting to play sports. And young trans athletes came to speak to say, this enriched my life. It helped me feel part of a community. And it still, with very little comment, moved forward.
You bring up an interesting point. LGBTQ plus people make up a small percentage of the population. It would seem to me that trans individuals make up an even smaller percentage of the population, and yet they're getting the white hot heat of all this focus. Does it make any sense?
It makes sense only in so much as it's always happened. So when we talk about your earlier question, which I missed, but I want to respond to, about what we're seeing in terms of hate crimes, of seeing young people being attacked, it is consistently young Black trans women, and it has been. So it is a story that we are highlighting more, and it is something that we are thinking about because the movement chose to push forward the rights of lesbian, gay, and bisexual people. And that made sense at the time. We were trying to make sure that things made sense politically. And so now trans people were left behind. And now the work is to try to create laws and bills that are inclusive. And so of course there's a backlash against that. It is, to me, fear-based, not rooted in any research, and to your point, a disproportionate number of bills against a group that makes up such a small percentage of our population.
Rodrigo.
Yeah, well, it is a good point about what a small population we transgender people are. You know, there's a lot of research still being done and try to figure out how many of us are out there. But roughly, it seems like we're maybe 1% of the population, maybe. So tiny fraction, right? And ironically, that is, I think, precisely why some politicians are trying to target transgender people. Because if you go after a group of people who are such a small minority, then you can get away with a lot more negativity, and you can spread a lot more misinformation without other people realizing that they are being misled. So strangely, it's precisely because we are such a small population that we are being attacked so aggressively. But that is such a cynical political strategy, and such an undemocratic way to do things. And, you know, I think most Americans can agree that at the very least, there are higher priorities, even if maybe you have conflicted feelings about transgender kids playing school sports or accessing transition-related healthcare. You probably still agree that there are way higher priorities like gun violence and inflation than going after trans kids. Mm-hmm.
And there is at the bottom of this, the individual person who is the recipient of all of this attention and some would call hate. The Gay and Lesbian Straight Education Network, which works to end discrimination, harassment, and bullying based on sexual orientation or gender identity and expression, says that 75% of transgender youth feel unsafe in school. And those who persevere, who stay in school, have significantly lower GPSs. Some fear comes out in hostile peers, but some of the mistreatment also comes out among school officials who target these individuals because essentially they have been given permission to. Are these legislative moves around the country opening the door? Is it a permission slip to go after these young people? Sarah.
Absolutely. So Time Out Youth has a dedicated staff member that works solely on educating school administration, teachers, professionals on what it means to be safe and affirming. And we use the GLSEN data a lot to talk about how important it is. And what happens when we're talking about these policies at this level is that they trickle down to things like school board policy. So if we're going into a school that doesn't have a policy to protect LGBTQ youth, meaning that their name and pronouns are honored, they can use the bathroom that they want, any of those things, then it's up to the individual teacher or administrator to determine what happens to that young person. And that is informed by the political commentary that's happening. So what we're seeing as our team is going into schools trying to do this work is this push and pull. Those that are really nervous for young people and really want to protect them no matter what their school says. And then those that are like, oh, well, now I have permission to engage with young people in this way because look at what my politicians are saying. Again, another reason that families that are supportive will leave the state if things don't change.
Hannah.
Yeah, I just wanted to add on to that. You know, there's a bill that already has passed one chamber in North Carolina that is very much education focused. One provision of that bill would ban teachers and school administrators from instructing in K through 12 classrooms on topics related to sexuality and gender identity. But there's another provision of that bill affecting all grade levels of public education that would actually require schools to inform parents of their children's pronoun changes before they're allowed to call them by a different name or pronoun in the classroom. And I've heard from several parents and trans youth that this would constitute forced outing, which could put them in a very dangerous position, not just with their mental health, but also, you know, it could put someone in a situation where they're, you know, in an abusive household or are, you know, kicked out of their house. And people are really scared of this, particularly in North Carolina.
I have less than a minute, but you brought up mental health. And we hear a lot about politicians talking about the need for greater mental health care, particularly in light of all these shootings that have been going around the country. When somebody is denied access to gender-affirming care, that can have, it seems to me, a severe impact on their mental health. When they are harassed or fearful in their places of education, that can lead to their mental health. Is that ever discussed in the halls on Jones Street, Hannah?
We've heard some psychologists come and testify kind of in the earlier stages of the legislature before Republicans obtained a supermajority last month. But I've heard a lot less time for public comment, you know, since they obtained that supermajority.
Hannah Schoenbaum is the North Carolina State House reporter for the Associated Press. She's here with Sarah McHale with Time Out Youth and Rodrigo Henleitinen with the National Center for Transgender Equality. We're coming right back at Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, incorporating Mazda's customer-centric vehicle design by making the customer the center of business to create a better car buying experience. More at MazdaofSouthCharlotte.com. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFAE.org. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about the trans kids being the bullseye of the culture war at the moment with Hannah Schoenbaum, who reports on the State House for the AP. Rodrigo Henleitinen is executive director of the National Center for Transgender Equality, and Sarah McHale is executive director of Charlotte's Time Out Youth. You mentioned a second ago how quickly these bills are going through our legislature, and it's happening around the country in Republican-controlled states. And I'm curious about, well, we know that the tempo has picked up in our legislature because of the sudden acquiring of the supermajority because of the defection of Mecklenburg County's Trish Cotham to the Republican Party from the Democratic Party. When Trish was a Democrat, she used to support LGBTQ plus issues. In a recent report, you wrote, Hannah, that she ran last year on a platform of supporting LGBTQ plus protections and opposed past legislation restricting transgender access to public restrooms and preventing cities from enacting new anti-discrimination ordinances. Has she changed?
She recently voted on a couple bills that, you know, we've touched on earlier. So I wanted to mention that just in the day that she switched parties and the following day, six or more bills relating to transgender North Carolinians were filed in the legislature. This was a huge quantity of bills that, you know, we'd probably seen drafted ahead of time, but that lawmakers waited to file until they knew they had the supermajority locked down. Among them, we had Trisha Cotham vote on a bill restricting transgender youth access to the sports teams that align with their gender identity. And more recently, she voted to pass a bill that would ban gender-affirming surgeries for transgender minors. And so, you know, I can't really speak to her own personal motivations for switching parties or the way that she feels about particular people or issues, but I've been hearing from her constituents and others around the legislature that her most recent actions represent a major departure from the platform that she ran on to get elected. And so it has a lot of voters feeling betrayed. They're saying, we didn't elect a Republican, we elected a Democrat who promised that they were going to uphold these values and protect our LGBTQ youth.
Rodrigo, the Washington Post reports that the kind of health care you get in general depends on where you live in this country and what kind of health insurance you have and where it comes from, et cetera, et cetera. Now, with these new laws being passed, transgender-affirming care or gender-affirming care also very much depends on where you live in terms of the availability of it. And you mentioned that there's a lot of lies and a lot of mis and disinformation surrounding what this care actually is, what it does, how it works. Dispel some of those for us.
Yeah, thank you so much for this question, because again, this feels like a new topic to a lot of people, so I understand why it will be confusing. But the truth is that any kind of transition-related healthcare that's out there today has been studied for over four decades. This was being practiced by physicians and researched by all the relevant institutions for many, many years before there was any kind of political controversy around it. This is longstanding healthcare. It has broad institutional support from American Medical Association, American Psychological Association, American Academy of Pediatrics, and there's really, really strict and detailed guidelines. So if you're a doctor who practices this kind of medicine, you're really going by the book with this protocol that's constantly being updated to reflect new research. And, you know, I think we can all agree that our medical system has a lot of improvements that need to be made, and getting healthcare should be a lot easier, not harder. You don't need to understand everything about what it's like to be transgender to agree that if a doctor tells you, you need this medication, you should be able to get that medication. At the very least, medical decisions should be up to patients and their doctors. In the case of kids, they should also be up to the parents. Those are the people who with the responsibility to make medical decisions, not politicians.
It does strike me as odd that the very people who wanted the freedom to decide whether or not to wear a mask are happy to tell you whether you can have gender-assigning drugs and surgery. Sarah, you wanted a copy. You wanted to comment on this.
Yeah, I just wanted to add to that a lot of the things that Rodrigo mentioned that are myths around what the care looks like. There are very few young people under 18 accessing surgery. What young people are doing, when we talk about trans kids and we talk about a six-year-old girl that I know who's transgender, it's a social transition, which means she's going to school, she's using she, her pronouns, she's wearing the clothes that feel good for her, and she's socialized as a girl. So when people say trans kids, I think there's often a belief that parents and doctors are permitting young people to have surgery. And that is a thing that has people feeling really up in arms. When we're talking about gender affirming care for minors, it's often a puberty blocker. So a way to delay puberty so that you do not have to go through it, which is a really harmful, I mean, puberty is hard for everyone, particularly harmful when you're going through puberty in a way that doesn't affirm your gender.
Let me flip the coin for just a second on this, because there are people who are concerned that you're giving a kid, a young person who may be 11, 12, younger, perhaps a little older, the opportunity to say and switch from one gender to another. And it could be a phase that they're going through, or maybe they don't have enough information intellectually or even in terms of the hormones raging through their body to really know in the final analysis who they are. And they may change their mind down the road. So, Rodrigo, you went through this. I'm just curious how we know that we're doing the right thing by allowing this to happen?
Well, every person is different and every transgender person is different. And that's why this healthcare treatment is always very, very customized. These are deliberately not categorical, like at this age, every transgender patient does this treatment. Instead, there's always individual analysis by every medical provider. Importantly, there's also always a mental health component. So you brought up mental health earlier. It's such a critical issue. A lot of transgender people really struggle with mental health. And as part of any kind of transition-related process, especially in the case for youth, patients see a therapist as well. So there is a lot of mental health evaluation every step of the way, especially with young people. And so that's really what helps ensure that everything is moving at the right pace. It's customized for the patient, very regulated. And if at any point something seems off, they can adjust the medication, take the patient off the medication, and there's really well-researched protocol for how to do it. So that's how we really make this as safe as possible, is providing really individual, customized care.
It's one thing to send a message to people, I don't care whether you're young, old, straight, gay, that you're not okay. That's one thing. It's a very bad thing to do that, but it happens. But some of these bills, however, not only say you're not okay, it criminalizes who you are. In Oklahoma, Senate Bill 129 would make it a felony for a physician or healthcare professional to knowingly refer or provide care for those seeking transgender procedures to anyone under the age of 26. That is well above the age of legal consent. I know that you're not lawyers. Nobody on this panel is, I don't believe. Wouldn't that be unconstitutional, and wouldn't it be overturned by the Supreme Court if it were taken that far? I'm not sure. Go ahead, Rodrigo.
Sure. Well, this is being litigated. In fact, many of the healthcare bans that have passed in other states have been struck down by courts or have had in preliminary injunctions issued against them in these early stages for precisely that reason. You know, our country is founded on the idea that all of us are created equal, and there are explicit constitutional protections of what's called equal protection. You're not really supposed to single out a person for less human rights just because of who they are. So that is the basis upon, or one of multiple bases upon which many of these transition-related healthcare bans are being challenged in the courts. And by and large, the courts are striking these healthcare bans down. So we expect that to continue because you cannot single people out for a different kind of treatment.
Both Hannah and Sarah want to comment on this. Hannah, I'll start with you. Go ahead.
Sure. So as part of my role at AP, I also help out with coverage of LGBTQ rights legislation, particularly trans legislation, in state houses around the country. So we track a lot of this legislation. And as you mentioned, you know, there were proposals around the country that raise the age to ban gender affirming procedures beyond 18. As you mentioned, Oklahoma up to 26. We've largely seen these proposals either dialed down or rolled back, or they didn't make it through the legislative process, except in a couple rare cases. The first being Missouri. We saw the attorney general in Missouri. He issued an emergency rule that would ban gender-affirming procedures up through adulthood. That is currently being challenged in court. It's been temporarily blocked in court. But that was kind of the first instance we saw of adult trans people having their care cut off by some sort of government order. The same is currently happening in Florida, where a law that was passed, it requires that only physicians and not nurse practitioners administer gender-affirming procedures. And that is cutting off care access to a very large population of trans adults in Florida. And, you know, Florida has the second largest population of trans adults of any state in the country. And so that's affecting a huge population of people. And while we're not seeing that same conversation as much in North Carolina, there are a lot of trans advocates around the country who are looking to places like Florida and Missouri, seeing the effects of of this of these policies and wondering, like, could this set the tone for what's to come in other states? You know, if the legal challenges don't hold or if they don't work, we could see this in the next legislative session where it becomes commonplace for somebody to try to cut off care access to beyond minors.
Sarah, go ahead.
Thank you for sharing that, Hannah. I was just going to add that when we're talking about this legislation, there is such a deep contradiction, which is how I believe that it's so clear that this isn't rooted in care, because the Parents' Bill of Rights was presented stating that young people shouldn't be able to make these decisions on your own, which, by the way, we made it very clear that young people cannot get access to healthcare without their parents. So you couldn't go and get a puberty blocker or something without your parent. But again, they presented the Parents' Bill of Rights. So they're saying that kids are too young and they don't know. But then they're trying to restrict access for transgender adults. What argument is there? We're not too young and we don't know at 26, right? So this is where it is an attack from all sides, focusing on children. But if it doesn't work with children, we're going to try to block the access for even adults, which is incredibly damaging, because you are telling trans people both that you don't know yourselves. Your question earlier was, what happens if a young person changes their mind? There's very little pushback, and there's also very little evidence that that happens. And we don't question that about any other gender, right? No one ever asked me if I was sure that I was a girl, if I really, really thought about that. I have identified as a cisgender girl for as long as I could remember. And that is the same for trans people. Just because it is a smaller population does not mean that our sense of selves are any different.
Some people on the right have positioned allowing this to happen to children, parents allowing them to have gender-affirming care, amounts to child abuse. And in at least one bill, I think in Wyoming, makes it punishable by 10 years in prison. If a parent and a child and a medical professional have consulted and decided this is the path this person should take, not allowing that, could that technically conform to the legal definition of child abuse? Of not allowing
it? I'll say that I spent the first 10 years of my career working in the child welfare system. So that's young people that were placed in foster care. And there was a thing called medical neglect, right? That is, if you are not taking your child to the doctor and you're not making sure that they're healthy. Now, I'm not sure that we're at a space where we would criminalize not accessing care, but it makes more sense to me than criminalizing someone for supporting their child. Because if you look at what we talked about, the AMA, APA, all of these associations saying this is, we call it gender affirming care for a reason, because it is life saving. And I truly mean that, not in a hyperbolic way. It is keeping people alive. So I would consider removing that access to be what the abuse is. And I'm not alone in that. And our young people are saying that. We lost a young person to suicide in the past month at Time Out Youth. And it was so disheartening to attend a funeral where they were being dead named in the space. And the young person had some moderate support from their family, but they struggled. And being queer, being trans is not the struggle. It is the way in which communities and families treat our community. And that, to me, was exactly what we're doing here. And that parent said that young person stayed alive as many years as they attended Time Out Youth. So they were still with us for as long as we had them because of a space like Time Out Youth.
Rodrigo, we live in an age of rage. That rage colors our perception of everything. It's opened the door to behavior and attitudes and language that have been thrown about that would have been considered shameful and completely inappropriate years ago, but now it just runs free in the wild. Your mother said something profound, however, in the New York Times in 2016. She said, "Every transgender person is a part of someone's family and should be treated with compassion and protected from discrimination." Is that something we've lost sight of? And can you get to that point if you are blinded by your own political ideology? I have 15 seconds.
Yeah, I mean, it is, that is really the most profound truth. And that is what cuts through all of the controversies and the bills and all of this politics of it all. And I hope that we can get back to that as a country, that every trans person and every person is a part of someone's family.
Rodrigo Henn-Leighton is Executive Director of the National Center for Transgender Equality. Sarah McHale is Executive Director of Time Out Youth. And Hannah Schoenbaum reports on the State House for the Associated Press. Thank you all.
Celebrating 25 years on the air, Charlotte Talks with Mike Collins is a production of 90.7 WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from Mazda of South Charlotte. Our executive producer is Wendy Herkey. The senior producers are Gabe Altieri and Sarah D'Elia. Our engineer is Joby Sprinkle. For more information about Charlotte Talks, to listen to past episodes, or subscribe to the podcast, visit wfae.org/charlottetalks. Additional support for WFAE programming comes from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
Support comes from WFAE members and Mazda of South Charlotte, focused on applying Mazda's customer-centric approach for vehicle design to car buying and servicing in order to create an experience centered around the customer. More at mazdaofsouthcharlotte.com.